Previously, on Fine Just Fine. Actually, this is an audio recording of the Rings of Uranus. Fooled you.
Hello, this is Wally Sherold, and you are listening to episode 1 of the season 1 premiere of Fine Just Fine on Syncbook Radio. Be a better song to start us off than Stardust? Frankly, I'm startled at how well Stardust starts us off. Staring at the stark stairway, I realize I'm starring in my own stereogram, starving for a single star. Could it be that two persons alive today on this planet share dust from the same star? Not necessarily in their hearts or their minds. More likely their ankles, elbows, but always their behinds. Science tells us such a thing is possible, so what should be expected if those two persons come in contact? Well, here we are, episode 1, season 1 of Fine Just Fine, and I'm not going to beat around the bush. The aim of this season, at least for the time being, and Anyone who read the manifesto has a good idea that things change
on a moment's notice or no notice at all. But for now, the aim of season one is to present a polite confrontation with the status quo. Particularly, I'm looking at you, theoretical physicists and philosophers of the world, who claim to have it all figured out and that it's all meaningless. And just trust us, because we've done the math.
Well, here's the problem. For many years now, I have been quite the armchair enthusiast of virtually every accessible and attainable documentary or other media pertaining to the subject matter of quantum mechanics, the nature of time, the nature of reality, the nature of space, dark matter, dark energy. Is mathematics nature or man-made? Is language nature or man-made? Is the universe made up entirely of bits of information?
Do ideas propagate themselves throughout the universe and implant themselves into the minds of humans and other intelligent species?
Is human intelligence merely a byproduct of a value-neutral trajectory of evolution throughout the universe, etc.? Now, the big elephant
in the room concerning the state of the art of the so-called pursuit of the theory of everything, which has really turned into more of a sport these days than anything, is that consciousness plays an integral role in the actualization of physical reality, period. And this has been proven repeatedly by experimental physicists. Quantum entanglement has been proven. The particle-wave duality of matter has been proven in order for any kind of matter to be described as exhibiting either wave-like behavior or particle-like behavior.
A human observer must be introduced into the picture. Otherwise, all potential behavior that matter can exhibit is occurring simultaneously at all times.
Counterintuitive? Well, that's the word that most theoretical physicists will use to describe it. But in my experience as an artist and as a musician and with an interest in poetic expression in any medium, really, whether it's actual poetry or painting or dance or any creative medium that exists, this is an idea that is quite simple and not very difficult to understand. And for those who work in the realm of abstraction, dealing with metaphors and dealing with language and dealing with symbols used to represent feelings and emotions and complex ideas, this is just another one of those ideas, and it's not that far-fetched. And more we're finding very persuasive arguments being made that for thousands of years, artists of some kind have been asserting similar claims, although typically through their own medium, and it's much more figurative in nature, but essentially is expressing the exact same kind of idea that theoretical physics has only recently just gotten caught up with in the last century, and has had to invent all of this abstracted mathematics in order to feel comfortable with such crazy ideas. Because we all know what happens when you can't prove a crazy counterintuitive theory without some fancy math. Boom! You lose your tenure. And then who's gonna sew the patches onto the elbows of your corduroy jacket? Your mom? So what are you gonna do? How do we address this big, glaring question? How do we reconcile the inherently confusing idea that our own consciousness defines our very reality, both inside our minds and outside our bodies? How does theoretical physics and experimental physics reconcile the big unknown in their field, the big divide between the very large and the very small, the big ultimate question to unify the field? This podcast aims to propose
one possible counterintuitive solution, and that is the answer lies in the very media on which we rely to express any idea.
To communicate anything from a theory of everything to
feed me, Seymour.
Anyway, I digress. The point is, throughout season one of Fine Just Fine, we're going to be speaking with many highly generalized specialists, or vice versa. The first of which is language scientist and entrepreneur Matthew Gugamus, who is an old friend of mine and fellow music maker. Matt is an excellent drummer and played for many years in my band MirthCon and enlightened all of us on the endless depth of that area of expertise.
When you learn another language.
Well, I'd say there...
what we're talking about, in, you know, in terms of language, there are three components of language. There's content, form, and use. And those are basically part of something. It's a Venn diagram from two researchers called Bloom and Leahy, and it basically describes the components of any kind of language. What makes language? So use is actually can be even broken down into like how you follow cultural norms in terms of communication, you know, like turn taking them. Are you saying something and then waiting for the other person to respond? Or
right.
And then you also have like modifying or changing language, you know, like, so, and that's what we're talking about right now. It's like, I got to use the bathroom, but I don't need to like speak to the person as if he or she, you know, he's the king or she's the queen. You're going to be like, you know, I got to take a leak. Where do I go?
Right.
I mean,
it's so much more efficient too.
Yeah. I mean, but the context doesn't determine why, or the context basically doesn't necessitate you're having to use formal language.
Right.
And then the last bit is using language to get your needs met, like being able to make a request or to be able to argue your point. Those are all part of communication skills.
Right.
Formalized language in terms of like, you know, like we're talking about when to use whom and when to use the subjunctive mood and all these other things that no one cares about.
Right.
They're formalized and those are put in place by the people who are in power. And so generally formalized language has been established by those who are in power. So it's like right now the main language is called generalized American English. So there's this whole concept of that's correct. That's just because those people are in power and making the rules. But the funny thing is there's actually real stuff behind Ebonics, and it's actually the correct term for it is called African American Vernacular English.
Can you think of any examples?
So, like, you know, maybe like he cool, right? You know,
he cool.
You take out the is. Well, the word is just means equal because you tell me. So why do you even need it there? I mean, if, you know, it's basically an adjective because like, let me take that sentence. He is cool. That right there, that's general American English. So that's considered a, you know. He is. So we can do it three ways. He is cool. Well, you can hear. And when you look at that, it's got three morphemes. Morphemes are individual units of meaning. They have like, they're the smallest unit that can carry meaning to it. Yeah, so possessive S, like you're talking about philosophers, the S, the apostrophe S, actually counts as its own linguistic meaning unit, a morpheme. So philosophers, when you have an apostrophe S, has an MLU, mean length of utterance of two. Same with philosophers as a plural. That also has a mean length of utterance of two. So when you say something like he cool, it really, all it means is, the way you break that down is there is a subject, he, then you have a verb, is, which is called a copula verb, and then it's connecting the he with the adjective that describes the state of being he is. He's cool, right? So why do you even need the is? Because what you're doing is you're attributing the adjective to the individual. And so that was probably, I mean, you know, I'm not even, I don't know what friggin' language is from, but it's a, there's a relationship between the, maybe the first languages people were speaking when they were developing Creoles, to their grammatical constructions they were using in their previous languages. So, and I'm not saying everyone who, you know, I mean, if you're African American, you're, you know, you're using African American vernacular English.
So, we were talking earlier about when I said the word shoot.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so that you've got a consonant sh, which, what is the name of that phoneme?
I mean, it does. It's just kind of just
the SH.
I mean, the way you would represent that phoneme is through using the International Phonetic Alphabet,
right.
And it looks like kind of like a
an integral sign.
It's kind of it almost looks like a stretched out S.
Right. Okay. Doesn't that have a name though? It's like
I don't know. I just think of it as the sh sound.
It's called the. What is it called? Yeah, here's the symbol. It's the stretched out S. I'll find it.
I don't know. I never bothered call what.
But it's like the alveolar fricative.
Oh,
I don't know.
Oh, that. Okay, that's what you wanted to do. Oh yeah. So basically, it's a fricative on your palate.
Those names are basically a description of the mechanisms that are used to generate that sound.
Yeah, it's a palatal fricative. So like, I didn't realize you were calling it. I thought you meant is it called like the omega or like?
Oh
some,
no, the palatal fricative.
Yeah, it's a palatal fricative. And so like an S is an alveolar fricative, and an F is a labiodental.
And that describes like how you're passing air through.
Yeah.
And what your tongue is doing, if it's touching your teeth, how your lips are. All of the envelope of the sound. Mm-hmm.
And the interesting thing is not every language has like all the possible sounds you can make. So like
right.
A palatal
except for Slovakian.
Is it how, I don't know.
I've heard that the Slovakian uses like every possible phoneme that we can create.
Well, my personal favorite, which English does not have, is the velar fricative, like the sound.
Right. Well, that's the rough breathing.
Yeah.
So which is actually a term. A phonemic term, but we'll get to that in a minute.
The most striking natural instrument of power in humans and in many animals is the teeth. The Greek myth of Cadmus tells the origin story of the ancient Greek and Phoenician alphabet. In the myth, Cadmus slays a dragon and sows the dragon's teeth. In terms of the extensions of man, the theme of the dragon's teeth is of the utmost importance. The teeth are an obvious agent of power in man, and especially in many animals. Languages are filled with testimony to the grasping, devouring precision and power of teeth. That the power of letters as agents of aggressive or learned precision should be expressed as extensions of the dragon's teeth is natural and fitting. Teeth are emphatically visual in their lineal order. Letters are not only like teeth visually, but their power to put teeth into the business of empire building is manifest in our Western history. Marshall McLuhan.
This is a very roundabout way to get to this other theory of the emergence of language, which is the mother having to set, what is it called? Proto-language. Let's see, here we go. So, list of proto-languages, proto-human languages, historical proto-human language.
The very first, I mean, I would say in terms of like, well, I want to hear what you're saying first, there are kind of universal the first kind of word that many kids exhibit is pointing. Which, interestingly, is absent from autism development. It's called a proto-declarative. And so pointing, when kids like, about the age of 1 year, like, your daughter's born, she'll like just see something and go like this.
Mm-hmm.
This. All my kids did that. They're pointing. And then you're like, kitty, doggy, mom, mommy, shoe.
And the index is a word that also means
Well, it goes back to pointing actually helps with eye gaze triangulation, and eye gaze triangulation is how you are sure that you're thinking about the same thing as someone else, and that's kind of the basis of establishing meaning for any word. Is that you have to know that when I'm pointing at this thing and you're calling it something, we're both thinking about the same thing.
Okay, here we go. The mother, is this it? The mother? No. Where is it? There's all these different theories. So what I'm looking at right now is the Wikipedia article called Origin of Language. Mm-hmm. And let's see here. There's this one theory that's related to what we're talking about. So I just need to find it. Oh, yeah. Putting the baby down theory. Mm-hmm. Okay. So, goddamn, Mike. Okay, here we go.
Yeah, motherese, actually, I mean, that's pretty common. And motherese, at least the way we were taught, is an actual kind of prosody when
right.
you're talking.
Well, that's true. And prosody is the song-like almost mm-hmm. shape, contour of how you speak, right? Mm-hmm. And prosody is actually a term I learned in composition. I had to take a class on, you know, Zoe, get down. I had to take a class on, you know, like writing a song in the sense of like a Schubert song, mm-hmm. right? And one of the ways that like a classical music critic will kind of judge the integrity of a true song mm-hmm. is its prosody, which is like, how have you set the text to the melody mm-hmm. that is what is the balance between it being melodically interesting, but also honoring, or if you will, the prosody of the spoken version of mm-hmm. the text so that it's you can understand as it's being sung.
Mm-hmm. Because prosody is like when it's off, it actually really negatively impacts intelligibility.
Right.
And one of the examples of that, I mean, you can find this stat somewhere, but like when you're in a signal, like, so we're talking about signal to noise. Mm-hmm. So when you're in a low signal to noise ratio mm-hmm. and you have someone who's a fluent speaker, English as a second language speaker, their intelligibility drops a lot. Because what happens is their prosody is often
wrong,
not correct. I mean, I know it's like with French. I don't have good French prosody.
There is this tendency, or I remember... It's less with morphemes, and I think it manifests more in phrases and larger chunks of morphemes.
When you teach people this, you can't do it. You teach them through something called contrastive stress drills. And so what you do is you take like a single sentence, like I have a car, and each word gets at emphasis, and it changes the meaning of the sentence. I have a car, not you.
Right.
I have a car. No, I don't. I don't want one. Or, you know, I have a car. I mean,
because right.
And so each time you emphasize those, I mean, there's subtext as a result of the tonal change,
right.
The prosody underneath. But when, you know, I'm not saying I can speak any Mandarin whatsoever. But when you change pitches, it changes meaning. And so changing pitches, that requires different muscles, you know, and they're going to be probably more in terms of pitch changes. You have something called your cricothyroid muscle, which connects between your thyroid cartilage, just like the front of your Adam's apple, and your thyroid cartilage, which is kind of like, it looks like a ring, or sorry, your cricoid cartilage, which kind of is like a ring shaped thing. And it houses where your vocal folds attach to these, you know, your retinoid cartilages and all these sort of things. Mm-hmm. But when you change pitches, you know, basically it's like a rubber band that's like, you know, stretching, and then it raises the tension on your vocal folds.
Right, right.
And so maybe that took a little bit less neural energy to control the up and down pitch changes. And
right.
So that would have been pretty efficient. And
Like,
I don't know. I mean, is it speculation?
Right. No, I know. This is all speculative. It has to be. But, you know, the thing is like, if we were to go back to that scenario with the two early hominids mm-hmm. out in the field, that suddenly one of them discovers that there's a predator mm-hmm. that's about to detect them.
Right.
It hasn't yet. Like, okay, there is one option where I use a vowel because it's loud and it's going to travel far, but that's going to reveal my location and we're screwed. So it's like, and it's funny you brought up the word, the fricative shh, which is the one of, you know, a very, not universal, but it's a widely used phoneme to say be quiet.
It's missing in other languages, though. That's what's, because it's not in, like, I think, like, I mean, if there are Tagalog speakers out there, you can correct me. I don't think Tagalog has that.
Okay. I didn't know that. But, I always say Tagalog. You know, emphasis.
But I mean, I don't know every, like, you know, sound. It's called phonological system. Each language has its own phonological system. And the trippy thing about that is the phonology that you're exposed to helps establish motor plans that, accompany, basically, when you hear phonemes. So your kid, you know, so you're going to be hearing, your kid will be hearing Italian and English. And so Sarah will be talking in Italian. And so those sounds from Italian will be part of one phoneme set that will accompany the whole motor movements to produce them. And then the other will be the English. Then you can have a whole bunch of phonological systems, but there isn't a universal phonological system. What there is a natural physiology to create rapid speech. And depending on the context you're brought up in, those are the sound systems that you're going to adapt to, and those are the motor plans you're going to create up until like around like the age 12, you're like 12, and then you establish a dialect, and you can learn other languages, but your phonological system will be based on your what's called L1, language one that you learn.
Right.
Yeah, it's got its own, it's like a, looks like a U, like a...
Right. What I'm saying is like, so, okay, so, but anyway, and to create the rrr sound, it's true that's like, as far as all of the different muscles and all of just the physiological activity that's, or whatever, or excitement, or whatever you want to call it, engagement that's required to produce that phoneme, it's like the most demanding.
It's one of it. Yeah, I would say it's definitely, I mean, I'm thinking of some others that are like, I'd say like velar fricatives, like from like German and like French are pretty tough. I think, yeah, it's because, I mean, that's,
it's definitely one of the hardest, right?
Yeah, that's the one that's like one of the latest developing sounds, because like people develop sounds on a developmental level, and R, and that is one of the last, F, and the J sound, J is the last sound to develop in English developmentally for kids.
So my theory is that the R sound, because when you think about it, it's like when you encounter a wild animal, or an animal, and I mean the sound that it makes, like to communicate aggression, or like more warning, I'm gonna fucking fuck you up if you come near me, is, you know,
you know, which is,
I love those, by the way.
They're very entertaining.
I mostly remember the guy's hair. But
I know, right? So, but this, some people even posit that there was this awareness of DNA in some capacity. Even, I mean, we had an awareness of atoms and these particles. And some people have claimed that, and there was some kind of an awareness of evolution. It's actually a real thing, and that some people have interpreted like Egyptian hieroglyphs and the stories of like the Egyptian pantheon as not really, like, it's very easy for us in today's context to think, oh, these were people worshiping gods that they, you know, would bow to, and they anthropomorphized them. But it wasn't really that. It was a very, very complex symbolic system to store real information about the world that they had gathered objectively.
Right. And, I mean, I was going to just chime in and agree with you. It's like, well, I mean, what if someone were, you know, this is kind of all coming full circle, but, back to the idea of context. What if you just take Finnegan's Wake and you read that and you just are like, you know, we're just, here's an ancient text, you know, and
absolutely.
You read it and they're going to be like, this is what people believe. I mean, there, yes and no. I mean, it's right. Stuff that James Joyce was thinking about, and he also used symbols to represent thoughts and ideas he had, and it required context.
It's the most complex pun ever written. But anyway, getting back to that. And so, I don't need to dwell on that. Okay, so let me resume. Okay, so
we were talking about envelopes, and I just want to demonstrate for everyone.
So
let's use a slightly less annoying sound. Okay, so this is a sine wave.
Yeah.
And all the ADSR parameters are at 0 milliseconds.
0 milliseconds.
Mm-hmm. So now what I'm going to do is
to
increase the time of the attack parameter. Okay. So now if I take the attack, let's say halfway, 600 milliseconds.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, that's not doing anything.
I was like, I'm not noticing it.
It's the wrong. I'm just doing the wrong parameter.
Got it.
Here we go. No, it's this one. So, okay, right. Because the reason that this is sustaining is because now that we're looking at the correct angle of the S.
Got it.
Now I'm going to turn this. I'll turn the S all the way down.
Yeah.
And
so
now
just,
I'm hitting it, and
a click,
it's a glottal stop.
Yeah,
no.
Like a glottal stop.
So I'll turn the sustain back up. And now. Right? But now if I turn the. So about 500 milliseconds on the attack. Now when I hit the key, what? Listen.
Oh, cool.
So
the attack, it gradually fades in. Versus like a.
Yeah.
Like a total, you know? Open the floodgates attack. Right? And then if I. Let's say, I'll do the duh. Oh, now I'll turn the decay up to about. I'll go all the way. 1 second. It's still it.
Yeah.
It still sounds basically the same because the release is
offsets it.
So now I'm going to turn the release all the way out. So now the attack is at 0 and everything else is at 1 second. So that's what this sounds like. I've let go of the key now, but the release now is taking much longer time to die down. So when I turn the release all the way off, I'm gonna do is put my finger down, play the tone, and THN lights up, and you hear what happens. It stops immediately.
Right.
You can still hear that one up.
Yeah, the previous one, yeah.
Right? Okay. So, basically, and if we were to pull up a graph of this, let's see. ADSR envelope. I'm just gonna go search, and boom, images.
I encourage listeners to Google ADSR envelope and look at the image results. And you'll see what we're looking at.
And it's basically an XY graph. And you see this shape looks like, okay, it's amplitude over time. So we, like this one, for example, is kind of like a slow attack where there's an angle here. Right, so we're, the time it takes to reach its maximum amplitude is its attack, right? So something that looks like that graph would have something kind of like this, where it fades in.
Right.
Right? And then the decay is the time it takes to kind of fall back down from its maximum amplitude to its sustain amplitude.
Right, yeah.
So now it's like. You know, a vowel is obviously, or a basic, okay. When you consider the envelope of a sound, of an utterance, of a like the way I described a synthesizer, so a word has an attack, a decay, a sustain, and a release, okay? And that word has, and this, and if we're talking about like proto-language and proto-humans or whatever, where there's a very small vocabulary, right? And let's say there's a mother who has set her baby down and she's cooing and cawing or whatever to keep the baby. And then, but she catches a whiff of something or just has an intuition and lo and behold, she spots a saber-toothed tiger, you know, who is grazing and hasn't detected them yet. Okay. Let's say they're out in a grassy knoll or something like that. And let's say that's kind of windy out. Okay. And she needs, and basically she can't, she deduces very quickly that, okay, I can run over to my baby and snatch my baby so that, and we escape. I can Well, let's say it's not even a baby. Let's say it's a child who is already, you know.
Someone,
a minor who needs protection.
Right, or just another, a receiver who needs to understand critically that there is this very serious impending danger, okay, that is very real. And, okay, so it's like, who are the, when you consider evolution, what are the, what's the envelope of the sound that is going to successfully convey in the least amount of noise, in the, like, requiring the least amount of morphemes, that will, that maybe, let's say it's pretty windy out. So you can't use any high frequency sounds because they're going to get completely muffled. So you have to consider the medium that you're communicating over. And it's not, well, the other thing is they understand what a scientific theory is versus the word, the more colloquial term theory.
Yeah, theory, you know, because it's a, well, theory has, is a homonym for theory. So
that's beautiful.
That, so, when, you know, when you look at what Darwin was doing, I mean, he was observing stuff. And then he was writing it down and noticing things that could be reproduced. And in fact, he rushed to publish his stuff before another guy, I can't remember his name, because I read The Origin of Species a while back, but...
Oh, there's another guy that posited it,
too. Yeah, and that happens a lot, you know, like, I think...
like you said, because we only have a limited... you have to recycle language, and same with ideas.
Yes, if you came across calculus, I think, I can't remember, was it Spinoza or something came up, or I don't know, someone else besides...
Well, Archimedes, they now realize, like, invented calculus.
I mean, they have the same brains we do. And here's the thing, it's like, we're looking at people who have, who biologically, I mean, and we can look at this, you know, and I'm not an evolutionary, like, biologist, but, I mean, if you look at people's DNA, there's a way to look at the tail of the DNA or something. I mean, forgive me if I'm not explaining it right, but where it shows the number of, you know, I guess, iterations of it over time that have happened, and so, you know, you can kind of, like, show...
it's a record, almost, of its own... self-organization.
Yeah, it might be in the RNA. I don't know. But also like a mitochondrial DNA. Mitochondrial DNA is only passed on by mothers. And mitochondria are the things that allow, they create energy for your whole body. I mean, they make ATP. You know, it's called adeno triphosphate or something. But that's everything that powers everything in your body, like moving your muscles.
And it's only transmitted by mothers.
By mothers. And the DNA is, there actually were little bacteria that we've
So they don't. This doesn't exist in males.
No, mitochondrial DNA cannot be passed on by males. It only is passed on through mothers.
Oh, so in their chromosomes.
In their chromosomes.
So okay.
If you don't have mitochondria, then you have no way to fuel your body. I mean, because ATP is required to release like neurotransmitters to move your jaw.
ATP.
Everything.
Pata.
You know. There you go. Backwards, right? That's an apophony right there.
Yeah, that is a, is it apophony or apophany?
Apophany.
No, it's, you shouldn't confuse.
Apophony, is that what it is? I don't know.
No, but I love the fact that if you think that there's any significance to the connection between apophony and apophany, it's apophany that you're experiencing.
Yeah.
Because of the vowel change.
Yeah, there you go. Yeah.
This is a good note, just in the interest of time, that we were managed to wrap it all up, that ATP and PTA are...
possibly related or not. However,
exactly.
People haven't changed very much in a hell of a long time.
Yeah.
So it's potential. There's a real potential that other people may have been onto the same things that modern humans are thinking about now. And given the fact that a lot of civilizations have destroyed the ancient works of others, we'll never know.
It's true. Thank you, Matthew Gugamus, for joining me here on Fine Just Fine. This has been an incredibly fascinating discussion that I hope we will continue.
We will continue on. We have other conversations we can have.
Oh yeah, I mean, I literally just had to put the kibosh on it because I detected we could be sitting here for days and days and days, and I have to pee. So this has been Wally Sherold signing off on Fine Just Fine. Ciao.